Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. If you can't say it, you can't do it.
Welcome to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I'm your host. My name is Franz. Well, I've been out and about. I've been in Cambodia, Thailand, and Myanmar. And I'm going to try to make this a relatively quick introduction because I'm still fighting a cold that I caught while I was traveling. Now, if you've been traveling and you catch a cold or catch an illness, that's a pretty miserable way to be traveling. But the last 2 days that I was in Myanmar, I came down with a very miserable cold, and it wasn't till today, which is 5-6 days later, that I'm feeling half decent. So I'm going to do a quick introduction. Actually, it's going to be longer than I'd like it to be, but I want to review a few letters. I want to bring you up to date. Then I'm going to outline the rest of the program. I was featured on a guest on 59 North podcast, Andy Scheel, and also Teddy Jennings' podcast, Sail Loot podcast. So if you want to hear some more of me, you can go over to those podcasts. Those are fun podcasts to listen to, so I recommend them. And if you like listening to podcasts like I do, and you want to get some more information on sailing and some more stories on sailing, those are good podcasts to go to. I think Andy just put my podcast out on his website today. And it's actually it's a duplication of my conversation with him, but he didn't edit it quite as much. I edited out a lot of the introduction stuff and he left it in. But let's go through some letters really quickly. First one I got is from Scott Gorgeous. And he made sure I understood how to pronounce his name. It's spelled G-O-R-G-E-S, and I probably would have just said Gorgeous, but he wrote me back and said, no, that's gorgeous. Don't laugh. It's gorgeous. So Scott says, last week I was at a drive here in Southern California listening to your podcast and really enjoyed the one on anchoring, since sometimes this can be my weak spot. I know you have said how you enjoyed the Northwest. 1 year back, in 1997, I had the chance to sail around the Puget Sound in the San Juan Islands on a 46 Hunter with our family when we worked just east of Tacoma in Poliwhip, Washington. I knew that the Northwest had some tidal differences since I'd worked as a land surveyor there, and that the tides rise and fall, and there can be about a 6 to 11 foot difference in some areas. Actually, as you farther north you go, it's even larger. I think you can get almost up to 30 foot tides up in Alaska. So the farther north you go, the larger the tides tend to get. Anyway, going on. We did just fine the whole week out, and about the last night we landed back in Friday Harbor, and someone had taken our slip. So we said, no biggie, we can anchor outside, and in the morning we can check in. We laid a 4-to-1 scope in about 35 feet of water, forgetting to check the tide tables. We were at low tide, and my wife and mother-in-law kept saying the boat was moving. Me and my father-in-law said we were fine, we were on the water. Later that night, my mother-in-law said that the lights are getting closer. No way, we're anchored. Around 6 in the morning, we hear a big blast from one of the ferries. Yep, we had drifted right into the ferry lane, and he was coming right into port. We both jumped up in our boxes and started the cold engine, pulled up the drifting anchor so fast that our heads were spinning. And from now on, we are reminded that sometimes we do not know how to anchor. So I listened yesterday on my drive from Palm Springs to Irvine, listened to your podcast on anchoring, and others that I've downloaded. Georges, thanks for that heads up. You know, I don't think I've mentioned the rise and fall of tides that much. In the Mediterranean, I don't have to worry about it. But let me tell you, when I sailed up in the Northwest, up in the San Juan Islands and the Gulf Islands, yeah, that was something I always took into consideration. And some of those anchorages up there are fairly steeply banking. So if I could take a line to shore, I always felt a lot more secure because sometimes you can't get enough scope. If the wind shifts and it pushes you out to deeper waters, you don't have the scope. Your anchor is just sort of hanging there on a ledge. So, yeah. Yeah, and I've probably anchored in that same area you're talking about in Friday Harbor. It's right at the entrance where the ferries come in and out. On the southeast entrance, there's an island there out in front of Friday Harbor, and there's two entrances and exits. The main one the ferries use, as I recall, were on the southeast exit around the southeast side. Yeah, and that Friday Harbor can get very crowded, very crowded. One of my friends who sailed with me in Sardinia, actually he sailed from the Balearics over to Sardinia with me, lives up in Friday Harbor. And he actually went sailing on, I think he had a passport 40, and he took off and went sailing. And he ended up having to come back, and he sold his boat a while back because of health issues in the family. But he lives up there in Friday Harbor now, and I did go up and visit him a couple years ago. Sailing up in the Northwest, Scott, is gorgeous. All right, another letter from Peter. Peter has written me several letters. Peter said, I just finished up the ASA 103 audio course. It was very well done. Did you use the ASA book as a guide? I was able to answer most of the quiz questions based on your material in the recording. Then he goes on to say, I don't recall you discussing prop wash and prop walk. I think that was in one of the quizzes at the end of a section. Perhaps I wasn't paying attention. Peter, you know what? I did not talk about prop wash and prop walk. I will add that section in the ASA 104. But it was not on the outline that I referred to when producing those lessons. And where I got the materials for those lessons was primarily my own experience, but the content, subject content information that needed to be recovered, I got directly from the ASA website. In the ASA website, they talk about what you are going to be tested on, so that's what I taught on. And I don't recall them mentioning prop walk and prop wash in the ASA 103, but I'll cover that in the ASA 104. Then he goes on to say, anyway, I wanted to write a review for the ASA 101 and 103 audio course, but couldn't find a link to do so. If you can send me a link, that would be really helpful. And of course I did, Peter, so I really appreciate you writing a review. I've got one review out there on the ASA 101. The ASA 103 should be in iTunes and Amazon probably within 2 weeks. I finally got the audios uploaded to the service. It'll put them out there for me. And here's an offer I'm going to be making to my listening audience. I need more reviews. And the only way I can get people to review it is to actually listen to them. So I'm going to offer 30 free downloads for the ASA 101 course, the basic keelboat certification. Now you'll have to download it through Gumroad, but I want you to go and review it in iTunes and Amazon. Now if you'll do that for me, and I don't want you to give it a review you don't think it's deserving of. I just want an honest review. So don't feel like you have to give me a 5-star review. I want honest feedback in the reviews. So if you will review it, you can have a free copy. Now there's no way I can really hold you to it. I just have to go on your goodwill that you will go ahead and download them, listen to them, and review them after you've listened to them. I can't hold your feet to the fire. I can't check on whether you did or did not do the review. But be honorable. If you're going to download them for free, please give me a review. I'm limiting this to 30 downloads. So the first 30 people that go onto the website and go to the products and download it through Gumroad, this is the ASA 101 course, the basic keelboat certification. When you go to checkout, you will need to put in the offer code ASA101REVIEW. And then if you put that offer code in there, that will take $29.99 off the price, effectively making it free for you to download. Now, Peter wrote me back another email, and he said, just a tip for people who download the ASA lessons on Gumroad, if a user wants to put the lessons in their iPhones, they should go to Dropbox.com, set up a free account, Next, back in Gumroad, they can select to save button and save to Dropbox. And so with Dropbox, you can go ahead and listen to those, I guess, in your, yeah, you can. You can listen to them through the app in your iPhone or Notepad. So there's a good heads up from Peter. Thanks, Peter, for that heads up. Lastly, I got another email from Paul and Cheryl Shard. They're having a special for Valentine's Day, and this is the special. And I'm going to read the note they gave to me. I just want to let you know that we're running a Valentine's special on the Distant Shores Super PAC. This week through midnight Pacific Standard Time on Saturday, February 14th. During the special, anyone purchasing the Super PAC will receive two bonus gifts. One, all 123 half-hour episodes of Distant Shores as downloadable versions, as well as the DVDs. They will receive the promo code automatically when they order so they can start watching instantly. Two, a downloadable version of Let's Go Cruising Anchoring, the first in a new series of how-to videos we're producing, demonstrating skills and techniques in a variety of weather conditions, such as anchoring in a mangrove during a tropical storm, as well as many beautiful locations around the world. Now, I'd like to learn how to anchor in a mangrove. Even though where I sail, we don't have mangroves. That'd be good information to have. So I'm going to go take a look at that. All right, one last thing. If you want to download the Distant Shores videos, I have a link at my website. And if you do buy anything, I get a commission. Of course, you can bypass me and go directly to the Distant Shores website and buy it directly from them. But if you want to throw me a bone, go click on the ad that I have on my website, and that'll take you to Distant Shores, and then they'll know that you came from my site. Just a thought. So, for the rest of this podcast, I've got about 20 minutes that has nothing to do with sailing. Before I went traveling in Thailand, my wife and I wanted to go visit Angkor Wat. And before we left, I did a lot of research on how to get from Bangkok down to Siem Reap, or Siem Reap, however you pronounce it. Siem Reap is where Angkor Wat is located. And flying was very expensive, so we decided to do the overland route. And there were a lot of conflicting stories about how to cross the Cambodian border, how to get from Bangkok to the Cambodian border at Poy Phet, cross the border, and then continue on down to Siem Reap, which is about another two-hour drive from the border of Cambodia. So, because there was conflicting information, I just did it. I'm not one to write a big review on how to do it, but I thought I'm going to put a podcast out, an episode, a short episode on my experience on getting from Bangkok to Siem Reap and back. And then I'm going to post a link to this in Travel Advisor, because that's where I got a lot of my information, and some was accurate, some was not accurate. So if you want to just skip over the first 20 minutes, it has nothing to do with sailing. It just has a little bit to do with my trip over the last 3 weeks. Just skip forward about 20 minutes. If it's something that you might be interested in, go ahead and listen to it. Now, I did a few on-the-road podcasts while I was traveling. And if there's an interest in those, even though they have nothing to do with sailing, drop me a note. Because I was thinking I'd load them up here, but I don't know if you guys are interested in it or not. But it was about the travels in Myanmar, in Thailand, Bangkok, Chiang Mai and Chiang Rai, and then Angkor Wat and Siem Reap in Cambodia. If there's any interest in me posting those or putting them as part of my podcast, let me know. Now, for the rest of the lesson, I'm going to do a sample lesson from the ASA 101 series. This is going to be lesson number 13. So just a sample of what you get with the ASA 101 course. All right, keep those letters coming. I appreciate it. I'll be interviewing Paul and Cheryl Shard again in a couple of weeks. And I think Andy and I will do another interview together as well. Andy Scheele at 59 North. Let's get on to the rest of the podcast right now. This is my account on taking a train and taxi to Siem Reap from Bangkok and back. been traveling in Thailand, wanted to visit Angkor Wat in Cambodia. I did a lot of research ahead of time on various forums on how to go from Bangkok to Siem Reap and back. Now, Siem Reap is the city where Angkor Wat, or Angkor Wat, is located, and the temples of the Khmer Empire at that time. The major temples of the Khmer Empire. There's Khmer temples all through Thailand and all through Cambodia. But this is the famous Angkor Wat, which is a World Heritage Site. I'd read a lot of accounts, and I was a little confused on how to go about doing it. But the choices to go from Bangkok to Siem Reap are, number one, you catch a flight from Thailand, from Bangkok, to Phnom Penh. And then you have to catch a taxi from Phnom Penh to Siem Reap. I didn't want to do a flight. Number one, it's expensive, very expensive, because Thai Airways is the only airways that serves that. And number two, when I travel, I'm traveling because I want to see the countryside, I want to see the culture, I want to see the people, I want to see the geography, the flora, the fauna. A plane doesn't do that for you. It may be quick, but I was not in a hurry. My point in traveling is to get a feel for the country that I'm visiting. So, all right, a flight was out. The other choices are to go by train or bus or cab. So a cab will not take you you cannot take a cab all the way to Siem Reap. You could take a cab from Bangkok to Apropet, which is the border town. And that's Apropet on the Thai side and Phoi Phet on the Cambodian side. It's where the two towns meet, is at the border. So you could catch a cab to the border. I checked that possibility out. That was going to be about 3,500 baht, or about $115 for that cab ride. It's about a 3.5 hour cab ride. The other options are to take a bus. And I had read a lot of accounts that every bus trip was a scam. Now, our hotel was willing to book us into a package tour, but I detest package tours. So we chose to do it ourselves. And we were going to do a cab, but I decided let's do a train. We weren't in a big hurry, and the train left at 5:55 in the morning from the main train station. There's a couple train stations, but it was a train station that was very close to us where we were staying in Chinatown. And it was supposed to arrive at about 11:35 at the border, at the town at the border. As it turns out, it didn't really arrive until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The cost was almost nothing. The cost per person was less than 50 baht per person. So for two people, it was less than $3, so less than 100 baht. I think around 90 baht or 95 baht. It really didn't matter. But it was slow. It was slow. You're probably traveling about 35 miles an hour at the best if you average out the time you're moving. You stop at a lot of places along the way. Places are out in the middle of nowhere. So we chose the train because it really gave us a feel for the country, and we weren't in a big hurry. So once we got to the border, you had to catch a tuk-tuk from the train station down to the border. So the tuk-tuk is going to cost about 100 baht. And there's plenty of tuk-tuks there to choose from, and they all pretty much agree to the same price. So there's no really negotiating with the tuk-tuk drivers. These are the three-wheeled scooters with a carriage in the back, basically. So you take the tuk-tuk down to the border. There's a scam that you need to know about, that the tuk-tuk drivers will try to take you to an official-looking building and say, you buy your Cambodian visa here. That's a scam. Don't do it. Just tell your tuk-tuk driver that you already have a Cambodian visa, that you don't need a visa, and then he doesn't have the opportunity to try to take you to this building, which is a scam. and they charge an extra $20. So avoid that. Tell them you already have a visa, a Cambodian visa. Go straight to the border. You walk down this line to the Thai checkout, passport checkout. Now, I'm recording this, by the way, in a cab on the way to our airport back to Bangkok. So I'm on my way back right now. So if you hear any background noise, that's why you're hearing it. So you cross over, you go up some stairs to the second floor of this building where foreigners have to clear out of Thailand. And going across the border from the Thai side on the way down was pretty quick. There wasn't much of a line. It went pretty quick. You have your passport stamped. You walk out. You go down a long pathway between the Thai side and the Cambodian border check-in. There's some casinos there. And I guess there's a sort of a casino zone there that a lot of people from Thailand go and visit on weekends or whenever. We're not interested in casinos, so we didn't even stop in at the casinos. When you cross over to Cambodia, if you don't have a visa already, you have to go stand in line and get a visa. As you walk down this path, you'll have to cross the street. It'll be on the right. There'll be people trying to push you that direction. In our case, there was a man that was very adamant about where we needed to go. He was actually quite helpful. I was always skeptical. I thought he was going to try to sell me something, but he wasn't. He was just trying to be helpful. So he told me what building to go into and what stairs to go up. He was Thai. He went through a different line. So we went up the stairs, went through the passport control, then came down to the Cambodian side and went to the Cambodian visa. At the Cambodian visa, you have to stand in line, and the cost of a Cambodian visa in January 2015 was $30. Now, the local police add on another 100 baht, and you don't have a choice. If you don't want to pay that extra 100 baht, they're just going to make you wait. But that's not the official visa price. That's something the Cambodian police have decided to add on for their retirement fund, I guess. But you're pretty much forced to pay the extra 100 baht. So it's $30 plus 100 baht for the Cambodian visa. You get the visa. Then you go stand in the line. Then you walk down a long path again. You keep walking down. And then you find another passport control office that you stand in line at that, where they actually stamp your visa and stamp your passport. So you go to one line to get the visa, then you go into another line to actually cross into Cambodia. They take your fingerprints and they take your photograph. Both hands, they fingerprint both hands and they photograph you in crossing into Cambodia. I guess since we do that to all foreigners, they figure they can do it as well. When I say we, I'm saying America. The American government seems to be doing that to all foreigners as well. So other countries are taking on that task for themselves as well. Once you pass through passport control and get your passport stamped, you come out. And this is where you'll read different accounts on the internet on crossing overland to Siem Reap, to Cambodia, and then on to Siem Reap. Some people say that you need to avoid the bus, the tourist bus, which will take you to a transit center. One account I read said the tourist bus that you get on is a total scam. It's run by the police in Cambodia. And I don't doubt that it's run by the police in Cambodia. And that it'll take you 10 miles out of town, and then you're pretty much at their mercy at that point in time as to your transportation options. Another account I read said, no, this is legitimate. Well, I tried it both ways. I went and walked past the bus, and people tried to force me to get back in line and get on the bus. But I just ignored them and kept walking. And a man came up to me and said, I'd like to offer you a cab ride to Siem Reap. I said, how much? He said, $40 or $45, something like that. And I said, where's the cab? He said, follow me. I said, no, where's the cab? He said, oh, down here. And I did not get a good feel for it. I just didn't feel right about it. It just rubbed me wrong for some reason. And I'm a believer that if you feel something's not quite right,
just listen to your feelings and just do that. So I said, okay, forget it. We went back and got on the tourist bus that takes us to the transit center. Well, the accounts that tell you it takes you 10 miles out of town are now untrue. The tourist bus takes you to a transit center that's pretty much still in town. So if you don't like it, you can get out and walk wherever you want to go. You're not really out of town and out of touch. Takes you to a transit center in town. And at that point in time, you have several choices. You can take a shared taxi, a private taxi, or a minibus. We chose a shared taxi. Well, we needed three people for a shared taxi. There were two of us. And we said, well, we'll just wait for another person to join us. And they said, well, I'll tell you what. You pay for one more person, then you can have the taxi to yourself. Normally, it would put five people in a shared taxi. So five people times $12 per person was, well, a bunch of money for the taxi driver. He said, but I tell you what, you pay for three people, $36, you'll have a taxi to yourself, which to me sounded like a pretty good deal since a private taxi was, I think, $40 or $45. I think it was $45. And a shared taxi with just two of us was $36. So the math seemed to work out to me. It seemed to work out all right to me. But I made the stipulation that I said the taxi had to take us directly to our hotel. That he couldn't drop us off outside of town at another transit center, that he had to take us to our hotel. They said, okay, no problem. I said, okay, and I'll pay him when we get there. I said, no. You pay now. He take you to your hotel. I said, no. I won't do that because I've heard stories about people being dropped off at the transit center and then having to pay another tuk-tuk driver to take them to their hotel. They said, okay, you pay the taxi driver when you get there. I said, okay, fine. So we got in the taxi, and he threw another person in the front. So now he had us paying for three and another person paying for himself. And then about halfway down between the border and Siem Reap, he stops and picks another person up. But all three of them are in the front seat, and we are in the back seat. So we had the back seat entirely to ourselves. But it was still definitely what I would call a shared taxi. And even if we'd taken a private taxi, I bet he would have done the same thing anyway. So we arrive in Siem Reap, and what happens? The taxi driver pulls over to a transit spot, stops, takes our luggage out of the trunk. A tuk-tuk driver comes over and says, hey, okay, we'll take you to your hotel now. And we said, no, I won't pay the taxi driver until he takes us to our hotel. And the tuk-tuk driver said, no, we do. No charge. Just no. My agreement was the taxi driver would take us to our hotel. That was it. Now, there seems to be a bit of a turf war between incoming taxis and the tuk-tuk drivers because there really are no labels on the streets. So you have to have local knowledge to be able to find your way around Siem Reap. Well, we argued back and forth, and I just was adamant that I wasn't going to pay our taxi driver until he took us to our hotel. Finally, the tuk-tuk driver backs down and says, good luck on finding your place. Meaning, okay, we have the local knowledge, your taxi driver doesn't, so good luck. Well, the taxi driver starts driving around trying to find something. I pull out my paper, which has the phone number and the address of the place we're staying. And by the way, we booked through Airbnb, and the place we stayed at was just wonderful. It was about $14 a night, and it was a wonderful location. It was great. So, I've looked on Google Earth, Google Maps, and I have a map of about where it is, but again, the streets are not labeled, so our driver really doesn't know how to find it. Fortunately, he has a cell phone. Everybody in Southeast Asia has a cell phone. I don't care how poor they are, they have a cell phone. He calls up our Airbnb place, the place we're staying at, talks to the owner, and the owner basically talks him in, tells him where to come to. And it takes a while, but we eventually arrive back at our place that we're staying at. So this was good for the taxi driver. And the reason it was good for the taxi driver is now he knows where this is located. So he turns to us and says, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a ride back to the border when you're ready to go for $25. So that's a bargain. That's a good deal. So we took him up on it. So now he actually can come pick us up and take us back to the border. So we go visit Angkor Wat. We spend 2 days touring Angkor Wat, and that's about as much time as I wanted. I didn't really want any more time for Angkor Wat. And by the way, it's spectacular. It's worth visiting if you're willing to put up with hordes and hordes and hordes of primarily Korean tourists on package tours. But that's just the way it is. It's a World Heritage Site, and it's well worth visiting. So the end of our trip rolls around this morning, and I'm talking on, I think it's the 25th of January, 2015. 8:30 rolls around, and our taxi driver hasn't arrived. So I go down to the owner of the little B&B we're staying at, and I said, would you give the taxi driver a call? Because he did give us his card with his phone number on it. And he says, okay, sure. So he calls up our taxi driver, and then he tells me, okay, 10 minutes. Well, it turns out it wasn't the taxi driver we rode down with. I think our taxi driver either got a better deal or he forgot about it, but he arranged for another taxi driver to come pick us up. And again, this taxi driver had to call the owner, and the owner pretty much directed him to this, to where his house was. He picked us up and took us back to the border. And that's about two and a half hours from Siem Reap to the border. All right, let's talk about... So we arrived back at the border, and the line to clear through the passport control office is long and chaotic and outside. We're standing in this long line that doesn't seem to be moving anywhere, and it's not really even a line. It's just this crowd trying to force their way up to the passport checkout desk. And of course, guess what happens? A policeman walks up to us and says, hey, you want an express line? I said, how? He said, 200 baht per person. I said, how fast is it? He said, right now. I said, well, how about 300 for two? He said, okay. And I probably could have negotiated him down to 100 baht per person in hindsight. But it was another, basically, it was another payoff to the local police to get you through passports. So is it a payoff when you pay off local police that are offering a service to you? Probably it is. But if you want to do anything, if you want to move, you're pretty much at their control. This is not a free market economy down here, or maybe it is a free market economy. If you're willing to pay for faster service, you can do it. So we paid the 300 baht to the policeman, and he went up and got our passport stamped. And we avoided this big, long line, walked across the border, and then, by the way, if you're going to do this, stop for a toilet break before you enter the Thai side. Before you actually enter any of these lines, you might want to stop for a toilet break. And you may need a toilet break after a 2.5-hour cab ride. Just saying. Because we went across the border, finally got into the Thai side, and again went upstairs and went through the passport control upstairs. This time, however, the line was nearly out the door when we arrived. It was a long, long, long line with one person. And by the way, we did arrive near noon, near lunchtime. One person was at the desk stamping people out. So there's five desks up there. Only one desk is working. And this line is barely moving. We stood in line probably for about an hour and a half to get through this line. Eventually, they had five people working the desk. I think what it was is everybody was at lunch. And again, weekends are a bad time to cross over. We're crossing back on Sunday. And my advice is, if you can avoid Sundays, do it. Because Sundays are the days that Thais go visit Cambodia and come back and forth. So it's much busier on weekends than it is on weekdays. So we stand in line. And again, you have to fill out the same visa application that you did when you arrived by flight. Fill that out, have it stamped, and then you're across the border. Now, once you cross the border, you'll go by a taxi stand on your left. That's a legitimate taxi stand. If you need to arrange with a taxi, which is what we ended up doing, we pay 2,000 baht for a taxi. Interestingly enough, the cost of the taxi from going from Thailand to Cambodia is with 3,500 baht. Going the other way is 2,000 baht. So there's a difference in price going from Bangkok versus returning to Bangkok. So that's a legitimate taxi stand. So if you want to take the taxi, that's not a bad place to get your taxi. In fact, that's the only place at the border to arrange for your taxi. I tried doing research ahead of time on where to catch a taxi. I couldn't find anything on it. So there's boots on the ground on where to find a taxi. It's just right there as you walk across the border. But I couldn't find anything online telling me where to find a cab to get back to Bangkok once you cross the border from Cambodia going towards Bangkok. Now, if you want to take a minibus or a bus, if you go out, turn right, and there'll be a little cafe called Cross Cafe on the left. We stopped there and had a cup of coffee. It's air conditioning. They have Wi-Fi there. Then you can do that. If you continue straight across the railroad tracks, you'll come out, you'll turn right, you'll see the coffee shop on your left. Keep going straight across the railroad tracks to the 7-Eleven. The bus terminal is right in front of the 7-Eleven. And if you have the time, the bus is going to be much cheaper to get back to Bangkok. In our case, we didn't have the time, so we chose to take a taxi. So there's my account on how to go from Bangkok to Siem Reap and visit Angkor Wat and then back to Bangkok. We'll talk about the visit to Angkor Wat later on.
Now let's get on to the lesson example that I talked about earlier. Now this is a lesson number 13 in the ASA 101 series, Sailing Learn to Sail, Basic Keelboat Certification, ASA 101. In this lesson, we're going to be talking about anchoring and anchors, first of all. Let's talk about the basic type of anchors that you're going to encounter as a small boat sailor. And when I say small boat, I'm saying up to probably 65, 70 feet. The type of anchor I use on my boat, and I've been using it for over 30 years, is called a plow anchor, and specifically the brand I use is a CQR. Plow anchors are by far the most common anchors seen by cruising sailors out there because they seem to be fairly good in a variety of type C floors. The point of an anchor is basically just to keep you from moving when you drop the anchor overboard. And a lot of that grab that an anchor has in the bottom is dependent on the floor. What is the floor? Is it sand? Is it mud? Is it rock? Is it weed? Different types of sea bottoms have different holding ability, and different anchors are designed specifically for different types of sea bottoms. So if you know you're going to be constantly in a sandy bottom, then you probably don't want to be using a plow type anchor, even though it would be okay. There's other anchors that are designed specifically for sandy bottoms. So let's just go through the types of anchors and what they're designed for. You have what are called grapnel anchors, and these are basically hooks that extend all the way around a common shank. And the purpose of these anchors is to basically grab onto something, usually a rock, possibly some weed, but mostly it's just used to grab onto something, not to dig into the bottom, because they don't have enough surface area for the bottom to hold them well. Grappling anchors are really designed to grab onto something and hold onto something. And where I see these used quite often are around rocky shores where there's very little mud or sand, and they're just trying to grab onto some rocks and hold on to something. These usually have a shank with four or more tines, and I've seen, up to eight tines. And tines are, well, let's talk about the parts of an anchor. First of all, you have the shank, which is the part that is attached to the tines. Then you have the crown, which is where the shank attaches to the flukes, and the flukes in a normal Danforth type anchor are what digs into the ground. And of course, then you have a shackle at the end where you're attaching your anchor line to, or your anchor chain. It's easy to see in pictures. Just go on Google, search for parts of an anchor, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's pretty obvious when you look at a picture. So a grappling anchor just has multiple tines because it doesn't have flukes. It basically just has hooks coming out of the shank to grab onto something. There's another anchor called the Hirschhoff anchor. It was designed by the yacht designer Francis Hirschhoff. And it's basically the same as an Admiralty anchor, but it uses diamonds instead of flukes. I've never in my years of sailing heard anybody refer to a Hirschhoff anchor, so I don't think you really need to know what a Hirschhoff anchor is. But let's just go through what you really need to know. You need to know plow anchors. And plow anchors would include the CQR anchor, the Bruce anchor, the Delta anchors. And again, these are designed to plow into the bottom of the seabed. Sometimes they have a good ability to cut through weed. Weed tends to be bad holding. You tend to slide your anchor across weed. If you're anchoring over weed, you have to test your anchor to see if you're holding. Then next anchor we'll talk about is a Danforth anchor. The Danforth anchor is another very, very common anchor. It has a shank and two flukes, one off each side. Danforth anchors are very good in sand and mud. Not so good in weed and rock. So if the bottom you're going to be sailing in is basically sand or mud, these are great anchors to have. Another type of Danforth anchor that I use and is very popular is a fortress anchor. And it's basically the same design as a Danforth anchor. But instead of being made out of steel like the Danforth anchor is, it's made out of aluminum and has some very sharp tips that allow it to dig in very quickly. So a lot of racing sailors are using the fortress anchors because they're much lighter and they do have a very good holding ability in sand and mud. Not so good in weeds or rock. In weeds, they basically just skate over the bottom. Now, the Admiralty anchor is also called a fisherman's anchor. And these are the old traditional-looking anchors, which has a stock that keeps the anchor up, a shank, and a fluke, and two flukes, one off each side. So the stock, when it's dropped overboard, will keep the anchor from falling on its side. And so when there's pull on the anchor rod, it tends to dig one of the two flukes into the sea bottom. Let me tell you what I've got on my boat. My working anchor is a 35-pound CQR attached to 250 feet of chain. That's the anchor rod, is called the chain. What attaches to the anchor is the anchor rod, and my anchor rod is chain. Some people use rope, and the rope they would typically use would be nylon because you want stretch. Or it might be a combination of the two. Quite often you may have 30 feet of chain and then several hundred feet of line or rope attached to that chain. There's different reasons for having the chain. I like chain because, number one, it's heavy, and number two, it doesn't chafe. The problem with an all rope or all line anchor is you are sliding across the seafloor all the time. When you're at anchor, the boat swings back and forth through at least a 90-degree arc, and in strong winds, it'll almost be a 180-degree arc, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And if you have line, rope overboard, that's going to be wearing on the bottom. So I highly discourage solid line anchors, solid rope anchors. Now, I've been on boats where they might have 5 feet of chain and then rope on top of that. But my main anchor line is 250 feet of chain attached to a 35-pound CQR, which is a plow anchor. In addition to that, now remember, my boat is a cruising boat, and my insurance policy, besides my regular insurance policy, but the one I use every day is my anchoring gear. When I'm sailing and cruising in the summer, I anchor, well, almost every night. There's a few nights when I come in and may tie into a marina. But in Greece, where I sail a lot, you still anchor and back in. And we'll talk about some of those techniques later on.
I have, in addition to my main anchor line, I have a fully rigged separate anchor line, ready to go, ready to be deployed right on the bow, right in its own chain locker. In this, the road is 30 of 3/8 inch triple B chain attached to about 300 feet of 5/8 inch braided nylon rope. I've only used this a couple times, and it's usually only been when I've wanted to put out two bow anchors. And I have a 40-pound Danforth anchor ready to go up on deck all the time that I can use on this separate road if I need to. Now, why would I use it? Well, let's say my anchor chain broke and I needed to deploy another anchor fairly quickly. That anchor is ready to go on deck. I've got shackles already on it. The line is ready down below. All I have to do is undo a deck hole fitting, and I reach down there and grab the line, and it's ready to be attached. There's my two main anchors. In addition, right next to my Danforth anchor on deck all the time, I have a little Fortress anchor, about a 15-pound aluminum Fortress anchor. And I use that when I want to double anchor my main anchor. And this is a technique I learned when I was in Cape Sault Union. I was in a big Meltemi. The Meltemis were blowing. Meltemis are regional winds in the Aegean that can blow at storm force or gale to storm force for days on end. It'll be perfectly blue skies. And on shore, you really wouldn't even notice it. It'd just be a strong wind. But at sea, it's very difficult to sail, and quite often you will be port-bound. Well, I was port-bound just to the east of Athens at a place called Cape Sault Union. It's not known for its good holding, but it was the best we could do in the circumstances. We had sailed up from the island of Aegina, and as we approached, the Meltemi started coming up, and as we got closer and closer, the Meltemi built bigger and bigger, and we decided instead of going around the corner to the town called Lavrion, we better stay there for the night. Well, we ended up staying at this anchorage for about 4 days while the Meltemi blew. It was just too windy to go anywhere. Well, this was not known for its good holding. It was sand, and fairly hard sand. But we came in. It was in the evening. I threw the anchor overboard. Now, when you anchor, you need to at least let out 5 times the depth of the water you're anchoring in, at least. And that's called the scope. You need to have at least a 4-to-1 and preferably 5 or 6-to-1 scope. And the scope is simply the ratio of the depth to the line you're letting out. So in this case, it was about 30 feet deep. So we let at least 120 feet of anchor line out. And this is all chain. So that night, I turned on my GPS, zoomed in as tight as I could on my GPS. And as the boat swaying back and forth, you could see this on the GPS. And it was going back and forth through its normal arc. When you're at anchor and the wind's blowing, you'll go through these big, wide arcs, almost 180 degrees. Just swing to one side, and then it'll come back, and you'll swing to the other side. And all night long, we were swinging back and forth and back and forth. And I left the tracking mode on my GPS and was watching it, and I was waking up at night every now and then and looking at it, and we were holding. We weren't moving. If we had been dragging, we would have seen that arc change. It would have gotten farther and farther aft. We were just pretty well holding. Well, in the morning, I finally went to sleep because I thought, okay, we're holding just fine. I don't need to worry about it. Fortunately for me, behind me was open sea. So if I had dragged, I would have dragged into the open sea. There were no hazards to navigation behind me. So I wouldn't have dragged on shore. I would have just dragged out to sea. So it wasn't as dangerous as if I had a lee shore behind me. Well, in the morning I got up and my track on my GPS showed this arc, 2 sets of arcs. my initial set of arc and then a straight line going back about 50 feet and then a new arc. So sometime during that night, I had dragged anchor. Fortunately, I had re-grabbed the bottom. The anchor had re-grabbed the bottom and reset in the bottom. It was very clear water, and I can dive at 30 feet. It's easy for me to free dive down to about 30 feet. So I jumped in the water, swam out, and looked at my anchor, and I swam down and physically pushed the anchor shanks into the bottom as far as I could, basically the plow part of the anchor into the bottom as far as I could, and we were well. But there was another boat just to our port side. It was an older sort of traditional-looking motorboat. And they were locked in there. They were not moving at all. They were snug as a bug in a rug. So I swam over, and I wanted to see what type of anchor he was using. So I swam over, went out to the very end of his anchor line, and he had a plow anchor, not as big a plow anchor as I had. He had probably a 25-pound CQR, as I recall. But in front of his CQR, just connected with a rope of about 10 feet, 8 to 10 feet, he had a tiny little anchor. And the holding on an anchor is the angle that you are pulling on an anchor. The more horizontal you pull on your anchor, the more holding power you have on your anchor. That's why you have to let out at least 4-to-1 scope to at least get maybe a 30-degree pull on your anchor. But if it's perfectly horizontal, if it's laying flat on the bottom, there's tremendous holding power as long as the flukes are dug into the bottom. And in this case, it was sand. And he had a little Danforth anchor tied on to this line, which is attached to his main anchor. Now, his main anchor is sitting on the ground, attached to the boat. But that little anchor was pulling perfectly horizontal. And it was the one that was taking up the bulk of the strain of this boat. And I thought, wow, that is a clever idea. And I've adopted that technique ever since then. If it's going to be blowing very hard, and I know it, I will take my little fortress anchor and attach it to the front of the CQR anchor, my plow anchor, with about 8 feet of line. In fact, on my plow anchor, I leave attached permanently about 8 feet of line that just float. It just goes in the water, and if I need to attach my fortress anchor, all I have to do is take that line and tie a bullin knot with a couple of half hitches and a figure eight knot to hold on my little fortress anchor, and I will drop that anchor over first, slowly lower my CQR down so that the fortress anchor hits the bottom of the seabed first. Then I'll let the boat drift back with the wind, let it grab, and then slowly lower my CQR to the bottom, and then give it a good tug in reverse to make sure that I'm set. And again, if you drop on weed, you may not set, even with this technique. But if you drop on sand or mud, chances are you're going to be dug in fairly well. I always test my anchor. I always put my boat in reverse and test my anchor. I see a lot of people that don't do this, and I've seen a lot of people drag anchor when in the middle of the night the wind comes up that they hadn't planned on, and it is very, very difficult to reset your anchor in the middle of the night, and it's very easy to set your anchor in the middle of the day. At night, you really have no feel for where other people have dropped their anchors around you. And I've had loud arguments with people in the middle of the night that have tried to redrop their anchor where I thought my anchor was and would have created a lot of havoc for me, because more than likely they're going to drop, drag across my chain, pull up my anchor, and now we're both going to be in a pickle. So take your time when you're anchoring. Put out at least 4-to-1 scope, and the longer scope you have, the better. You are going to be constrained by the amount of scope that you can let out, dependent on how crowded the anchorage is. So when you're coming into an anchorage and you see a lot of boats already at anchor and you think you find a spot that's going to be good for you to drop anchor, find out from the other boats. Just go up to them and say, how much scope do you have let out? And they'll say, oh, I might have 100 feet and the depth might be 20 feet. So they've got about 5-to-1 scope out. And in that case, you could leave about 5-to-1 scope out. You want to be about what the other boats in the anchorage are, because if the wind shifts, if you've let a lot more scope out than the other boats, you're all going to swing around together, and suddenly you may be right on top of another boat or bumping into another boat because you've let more scope out than the other boats have. Just imagine all these boats swinging together and imagine going from one side to the other. And this happens all the time when you're at anchor. The wind shifts around in the night. And when you get up in the morning, you're pointed a totally different direction than you were when you went to bed at night. There's a term you probably need to learn. It's called a hawse pipe. Hawse pipes are what you run some of your mooring lines through, your dock lines through. Also, you may run your anchor chain through a hawse pipe. And these are basically protected metal areas that are not going to get chafed when you run your anchor line through. And they're usually very strong. When you drop a chain anchor overboard, you're going to let out your scope. Then you need to take the strain off. Usually you'll have a windlass. A windlass is a mechanical winch that raises and lowers your anchor chain. And most boats nowadays have electric windlasses, which makes it very easy to deploy your anchor, even if it's very heavy with anchor chains, because the electric winch or the electric windlass is lowering and raising your anchor for you. But you want to take the stress off of that point and put it onto a very solid part on the boat. Commonly you will have, in my boat, they're called bitts, big, heavy timbers that I take the strain off of the windlass and put it on the bitts. And I use a snubber. And the snubber is simply a chain hook that you hook on the chain and then tied to a nylon line. Oh, I think in my boat it's about a 10 to 15 foot nylon line. I run it through the hawse pipes or over the bow rollers, whichever the case may be, and then I attach it to my bitts. Then I let more slack out with the windlass, more rode out with the windlass until all the strain is taken up on the snubber. At a accomplishes a couple things for you. Number one, it gives you a cushion. So you don't have a hard slap. You don't get that with the nylon because the nylon snubber acts as an elastic band. Also, it's much more quiet. You don't hear the anchor chain rubbing on the hull or, in my case, the bobstay on the bowsprit. So we've gone through the different types of anchors. These are what the anchors you'll see on small boats. Now, there's huge anchors that you'll see on big boats, but you really don't need to know much about those. But you'll see anchors, and you'll be able to identify them easily just by the way they look. Are they plow anchors? Are they fisherman anchors? Or are they Danforth-type anchors? Talk about anchoring techniques a little more here. You're coming into a harbor where you plan on anchoring, a protected area where you plan on anchoring. There's other boats there already, and there's a nice steady breeze from one direction. So all the boats at anchor are already pointed into the breeze right now. They may be swinging back and forth a little bit, but in general, they're pointed into the wind. The easiest technique I've always found, assuming that it's not too deep and assuming you can get a good bite, is to come up right behind one of the boats that's already at anchor, as long as there's not already a boat behind it. You know, you want to be the last boat that does this. You want to come right up behind the last boat, assuming it's not too deep to anchor, and then drop right behind him. Come right up on his tail, you know, maybe 15, 20 feet away from his tail, his stern. Drop your anchor there. Let it out. Let out, you know, let's say in the case of 20 feet, let out 100 feet of anchor line, anchor road, and fall back. You'll be surprised how far back you end up being when you finally grab, because it's not going to grab immediately. It'll take a little while for that anchor to set in the bottom. Be patient. Take your time. I see people come in all the time don't even lower their chain down, but drop it in a big bundle on the bottom. So now there's this big pile of anchor chain on the bottom. Immediately put the boat into reverse, and guess what? They never grab, because they suddenly string out this big pile of chain on the bottom, and the anchor never even has a chance to dig in. They just start sliding across the bottom. Lower your anchor slowly. Let it hit on the bottom. As it hits on the bottom, let more and more line out until you get about 100 feet out. Sit there. Wait. Watch to see if you're dragging just with that. Probably you're not going to. But then after 5 minutes of just sitting there waiting, your anchor's had a chance to dig in the bottom. Now go ahead and put your boat slowly in reverse. Stretch out that anchor chain a little more, because you may not be totally stretched out, but put it in an idle reverse, just slowly backing up. Your anchor chain will stretch out. It'll lift off the bottom a little bit. It's called the catenary. Whenever you see a telephone pole, two telephone poles, and you see a line between the two telephone poles, if you draw a straight line between the two telephone poles, and then you look at where the actual line goes, you can see that it's lower. It's not a straight line, because you can't pull that tight enough to be a straight line. And the difference between the straight line and where the slope or the drop down and the drop back up of the telephone line is, that's called the catenary. You have the same thing in a sailboat. You have a catenary. So you'll pull back, slowly pull back. Assuming you hold, give it a little more throttle in reverse. And as I'm watching this, I'll be taking a bearing across the back of my boat between something on the boat and something on the shore. And I'll see that I'll be start backing up, and I'll see something on the shore move forward. So I'll be coming back. I'll see that I'm moving relative to the shoreline. Once I quit moving, I know I'm stopped, and I'll give it more and more reverse throttle until I'm pretty much in full reverse. And if I'm not moving, I feel usually pretty good for the night. That's how I do it. And I've been sailing for well over 30 years, and I've been cruising sailing for a long time, and that technique has served me very well. When you're coming into anchor, don't anchor too close to other people. And if you don't go right to the stern of a boat and drop behind him, be careful on dropping to the side of him, unless it's basically parallel to the beam of his boat to the side of him. Because if you go up to the side of him and drop ahead of him, you may actually be dropping on about where his anchor is, and you'll find out when you settle down. Sometimes you just have to deal with crowded anchorages. In Croatia, most of the anchorages are very crowded. On the Ionian side of Greece, most of the anchorages are very crowded. In Catalina Island, they don't really have anchorages there anymore. They have moorings. So you pick up a mooring. And moorings are just simply permanent anchors, big concrete blocks that are usually on the bottom of the sea, attached by a chain and line, and you use those to tie through your hawse pipes around your bits, and that will hold you for the night. Sometimes they have forward and aft mooring lines, so you would take another line to the stern of your boat. Mooring's another technique. I don't think you need to learn it for the ASA 101, but you do need to know some basic anchoring techniques. And I've described some pretty good basic anchoring techniques in this lesson. I could go on for hours on anchoring and stories of anchoring, but I think I've covered pretty much what you need to do. I'll tell one more story before we close out this lesson. I'd launched my boat up in Bellingham, Washington, and I was going to take my boat down to Oak Harbor. Along the way, there's some channels that you have to stay inside the channel on the east side of Whidbey Island. You have to go through Deception Pass, which you have to time because the currents are very strong. Then once you get past Deception Pass, along the east side of Whidbey Island, it's muddy and shallow. So you have to stay within a navigation channel. So you're using your lateral marks for navigation to navigate down this channel. I handed the helm over to my friend Roger, and he's out there looking with his binoculars way off in the distance, and suddenly we slow down suddenly, and the boat heels over a little bit, and he's run out of the channel, and fortunately it's soft mud, and we are stuck in the mud. Well, this is called kedging. We had to get off, so what did we do? We took that big Danforth anchor, that 40-pound Danforth anchor that I have on my boat, tied it to a stern line. I also have lines off the back of my boat for tying to shore. These are called my stern lines. So tied it to my stern line. He and I got up on the stern and threw it as far back as we could, and then we would pull in, we would dig in the bottom. Again, this was mud, so it was a very good holding anchor in this mud. And we pulled backwards, did this several times, and we were able to get ourselves off. That's called kedging off. Whenever you have to get off a bank, mud bank or sand bank, that's called kedging off. When you hear the word kedging, it usually means they ran aground and they just had to kedge off. They had to get off. Now, kedging is another term. You might use it just to move your boat, and you would move it by kedging it over, taking one anchor out, setting it, releasing the other anchor, and kedging over that way. But it's basically a way of moving your boat around with anchors. All right. Thanks for listening. Get out there and go sailing. Remember, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen out there.
All right. Thanks for listening. Again, if you want to get a free copy of the ASA 101 course, the basic keelboat certification course that I put together, it's an audio course. If you will review it in Amazon and iTunes, or one or the other at least, you can get it free. At least 30 of you can get it free by using the coupon code ASA101REVIEW, all in lowercase letters, ASA101REVIEW, R-E-V-I-E-W. Go there, check it out in Gumroad. So go to the website, go to Study Products, go to the ASA 101, and it'll take you to Gumroad. And at the checkout, put that offer code, ASA101REVIEW, and 30 of you who promise to write a review, an honest review, can get it for free. Thanks for listening. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, or if you have stories of your own to share with me, let me know. Love to talk to you. I think I'm going to try to get a hold of Scott Georges and see if he'll let me interview him on his sails. I don't know if he's done any Mediterranean sailing or not, but if you have, Scott, drop me a note. Thanks for listening.
Joe, you have something to tell me?
No, I don't think so.
I just got off the telephone with Bill Rutherford. Princeton can use a guy like Joe?
What?
Princeton can use a guy like Joe. His exact words.
That's unbelievable.
You're as good as in. I knew you could do it. Haven't I been telling you, every once in a while, you just gotta say, what the heck, and take some chances.
You are so right.
You've made me very proud.
I was just thinking, where we might be 10 years from now, you know? Thank you.